I'm delighted now to welcome back to the program Winona Howder. She's executive director of Food and Water Watch, and she's the author of the new book Foodopoly, The Battle Over the Future of Food and Farming in America. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
I'm glad to be here this morning.
So you will be speaking tonight at Collected Works Bookstore here in Santa Fe at 6, and then tomorrow at Moby Dickens in Taos at 2 in the afternoon, and then the next day in Albuquerque at Bookworks at 7 in the evening. This is a huge subject and deserves a tremendous amount of attention. Now, you grew up on an organic farm that is, amazingly enough, still in your family.
Yes, that's right. When I was 11, my parents, who were missionaries, decided to get back to the farm, and we moved to a very ramshackle farm in northern Virginia, where we were living at that time. And it was a farm that had a mile-long driveway, deep ruts. We didn't have electricity. Nobody lived in the house for decades. My dad never did get around to putting the plumbing in. And I learned about, you know, what it takes to grow food, plucking feathers, pinching potato bugs, chopping kindling, all of those good things. So I couldn't wait to get away from that farm and go away to college. But I learned a lot of valuable lessons, and as an only child, I did inherit that farm, which in the early 60s, when my dad got it, was really a world away from Washington. No superhighway going into the city. D.C. was a sleepy little town. Obviously, today it's on the edge of suburbia.
Now, it's still in your family, and your husband has an organic farm that serves this suburban community that actually likes to have organic food.
Yes, that's right. I happen to be lucky both to have inherited a farm that has not had chemicals used on it, and the fact that it is near a metropolitan area where there's a market. Not all farmers are so lucky. In fact, only about a third of farms in the United States are actually near a metropolitan area.
That's right. And that's something that I think is important to talk about. Let's look at kind of the big picture historically of farming and food production in the United States. I mean, what did it look like at the end of the 19th century after slavery in the United States of America? I mean, when I think of agriculture in America, I think of slavery in the South. Okay, post-slavery, how was food produced, say, 150 years ago?
Well, you know, we had many diversified farms, and people tended to have their own fruits and vegetables supplied very locally. People had to preserve their food. There needed to be canning and drying of food. And something interesting I learned in writing Foodopoly is that Montana, you don't think of Montana as a food production state, but it was really self-sufficient up into through the 1950s.
Is that right?
So what happened after the Civil War, when there were many farmers out in the Midwestern and mountain states, there was a real battle with the banks that didn't want to loan farmers money, and with the railroads that didn't want to give farmers a fair price to transport goods. And so there was a birth of a movement, a populist movement amongst farm groups that really went on through the 1950s. And that populist movement actually did fight for some benefits for farmers. Now, during World War I, the U.S. did become a food basket for the United States, and farmers were encouraged to produce as much as possible. So the bane of farmers is overproduction. So after World War I, there was a lot of overproduction, and then eventually there was all of the economic turmoil that we know of as the Depression. And during this period after World War I and the 1920s, things were very tough in rural areas, and 54% of the population lived in rural areas. It was many people had malnutrition. And one of the things that the Roosevelt administration wanted to do when they came into office was to actually improve the welfare of people in rural areas. And so what they did was institute some farm policies to deal with the problems of overproduction. Some of them were very common sense policies, like having a grain reserve, supply management so that there wouldn't be overproduction of commodity crops, and some programs to make sure that farmers could actually make back the cost of production.
Now, hang on one second. Let's talk for a second. I want to hear this, but let's talk about overproduction. I mean, under what circumstances would farmers grow too much food?
Well, you know, this has been, like I said, a problem for agriculture actually going back into the 1400s, 1500s in Europe, when farmers have the opportunity and they're afraid that they're not going to get a fair price for their food. They have every incentive to grow as much as possible to take advantage of their land and equipment. And so supply management programs have actually put requirements on farmers not to grow as much as they absolutely can, but that they could get a fair price for the crops that they grow, which means that there is a fair price for farmers and a fair price for consumers. And in fact, recently we've seen what the effects are of overproduction. In, for instance, 2007-2008, when there was massive overproduction of grains, and that caused wild speculation and low prices, and then prices went high, and the U.S. has always been the price setter for grains since after World War II, and that meant that people were starving around the world. In fact, about 200 million people went hungry because of the overproduction and speculation on crops.
But you were talking about what happened under the Franklin Delano Roosevelt administration.
Yes, so these policies worked very well to make sure that there were not too many crops, that consumers had fair prices, and that farmers were getting the cost of their production plus a little profit. Now, the U.S. did become the food basket during World War II, and after World War II, as Europe was really suffering from the devastation, the U.S. continued to produce food, and things were working very well with these Roosevelt policies. Now, the situation changed, though, after the war. Everyone knows from their history classes that the economic balance had shifted, so the financial center of the world moved from London to New York, and the U.S. had become an industrial giant. And there were a group of businessmen and economic leaders that really thought there were too many farmers. And at that time, there were about 6.8 million farmers. They wanted to see farms become much, much larger. They wanted to replace labor with capital. And they began lobbying for this.
And they wanted that labor to work in factories.
They wanted that labor to be factory labor. In fact, they wanted cheap labor. They were also concerned about the populist movement. All of these soldiers coming back from the war, going home to their communities, making a good living, and actually maybe having an impact on the kind of society that we were going to become. And so they wanted to see a lot of things change, including a lot fewer farms. Now, they began to make traction in the 1950s, and by the 1960s, some of these most influential individuals had been part of this organization called the Committee for Economic Development. This Committee for Economic Development put out a very large report with a number of economics departments, with many media institutions involved in it. And it was called an adaptive plan for agriculture. And they laid out why the Roosevelt programs needed to be eliminated, why the food production needed to be globalized. They recommended that grains be produced in the United States while fruits and vegetables would be offshored to where it was cheaper, labor was cheaper.
And it kind of worked out like that.
They actually, their recommendations, when you look at this 1962 report, it's pretty scary. It actually turned out the way they recommended it. They followed it up 2 years later with a report on trade, And many of their recommendations actually came into being when the U.S. joined the World Trade Organization and trade agreements like NAFTA. Certainly, their recommendations about food and food production were to become public policy. Now, in the 1970s, there was a Secretary of Agriculture named Earl Butz who gave farmers the advice that they needed to get big or get out. And this became USDA policy, and they did everything that they could to encourage farmers to borrow a lot of money, buy a lot of land, plant fence row to fence row, and if they couldn't do that, to sell the farm to someone who could. And unfortunately, this advice was taken by many, many farmers. And that meant that they were depending on this export market for grain. Well, there was only one year in the 1970s that there was an export market. So many, many farms were lost because the farmers couldn't pay back the bank. There was massive overproduction of grains, and we literally lost hundreds of thousands of farms. Now, going into the 1980s with the Reagan administration, there was a lot of pressure as these multinational companies, not just food, many different companies were beginning to get larger, and especially with the trade agenda that they had, they wanted to be able to get rid of the laws that had prevented companies from absorbing their closest competitors, called antitrust law. And one of the first targets of the Reagan administration was to rid our nation of antitrust regulation, or to severely weaken.
Which is really ironic, just in terms of their own ideologies, because they were always touting the beauties and wonders of free market capitalism and competition while doing the exact things that created monopolies and eliminated capitalism, real competitive on the ground capitalism.
It is the biggest irony for our economic system that we've gotten rid of the laws that really prevented unfair competition. And under the Reagan administration, not only were the budgets cut, staff cut, and policies that had been against the law, like allowing competitors to merge or acquire one another, they actually narrowed the definition of what an antitrust violation is. So not just in food, but every aspect of our economy, we have massive consolidation with a few big players controlling every industry.
There is such a profound corporate hostility to essentially egalitarianism, to a kind of democracy, the way it works on the ground with, in this example, self-sufficient family farms that make and keep their own profits. You what you eat is what you grow. You have some extra, you sell it, you make a profit on that. And that seems to be the exact opposite of what these folks wanted. They wanted to own the fruits of these farmers' labors and land.
And that's exactly right. I mean, I think that what we're suggesting with having to reinstitute some of these antitrust provisions is as American as apple pie. We're actually talking about making the economic system work for people, not just the top 1% or the top 0.5%. We want an economic system that works for everyone. And what's happened with food policy is, after the Reagan administration into the 1990s, with the adoption of the trade policies, joining the WTO, and then NAFTA and many other trade agreements, there was pressure to completely deregulate farm policy, getting rid of all of the vestiges of those 1930 laws, which resulted in massive overproduction. We got rid of common sense things like the grain reserve. I mean, China's had a grain reserve since something like 37 AD. And having a grain reserve means that farmers store grain on their farm during years of abundance, and then when there's a grain failure, they pull it out. I mean, you would think that this would be something rather common sense, not a radical idea. But the grain traders, the food processing industry, they were among the economic interests that wanted to get rid of any of the policies that prevented overproduction. So in 1996, the so-called Freedom to Farm Farm Bill passed, and that completely did away with any government intervention in supply management. And very quickly, farmers were calling it freedom to fail. Within 2 years, the price of corn had dropped 50%, the price of soy dropped 40%, and by 1998, there was so much pain in rural areas that there was a lot of pressure on Congress to do something. So rather looking at the policy mechanisms that help prevent overproduction and doing some common sense things, they instituted a subsidy system that would help keep farmers afloat, but would ensure cheap overproduction of these ingredients that are used in processed food. Now, what happened is that this overproduction really benefited the soda industry, for instance. They saved about $1 billion the first few years. The meat industry was completely restructured by this because in 1995, as the antitrust laws were being done away with, we did see the meat packers begin to get more power, and about 30% of hogs were raised on factory farms, as an example. After the cheap feed, by 2007, 95% of hogs were raised on factory farms. That's because of the elimination of antitrust laws that allowed the meat packers to get bigger, and then the cheap feed that meant these contract operations could buy feed when usually farmers had produced their own feed. Meanwhile, it was very, very difficult for farmers to make a living, and has continued to be so to this day.
We're talking to Winona Howder about her book, Foodopoly, The Battle Over the Future of Food and Farming in America. Now, there is a term called vertical integration. Just what is that?
Well, vertical integration is when one company owns the production of food from farm to brand in the grocery store. So let's use poultry as a good example. So a company like Tyson, which is the largest poultry contract vertically integrated company in the United States, it owns the bird's genetics, it owns the chicks, it provides the chick to a contract grower who is like a chicken sitter. They have to invest the money in these huge warehouses where 300,000 birds are raised and can barely turn around. The company comes in and checks on the birds, provides the feed that's laced with antibiotics and arsenic to make the meat nice and pink. They pick up the chicken after between 35 and 45 days. They hire the contract chicken catcher who comes in and grabs them by their legs and puts them in the Tyson's truck and takes them to Tyson's slaughter facility. And recently the poultry industry has been able to lobby, and they can now slaughter birds at 175 birds per minute. And they've lobbied the government to allow them to dip these fecal matter coated carcasses in things like trisodium phosphate and chlorine. Tyson then takes this meat dipped in the chemicals so that hopefully it's not going to poison anyone, and packages it and sells it in Walmart or Target or one of the giant grocery stores under its own brand name. And that is the most kind of radical form of vertical integration. So meanwhile, the contract growers who take out all the debt for this, usually as a last-ditch effort to save their family farm, their promised high profits, they never really make a living. They make an average of between $12,000 and $15,000. And if there's a problem with the waste going into a local stream, they are legally responsible. So they take on the debt and the waste. And that's why Tyson can produce chicken cheaply and make so much money doing so.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, there are so many problems with this model, and one of them is that, I mean, there are environmental problems, there are problems with inspections, there's problems with political power. I mean, they make so much money that they influence the process. And there's also real labor problems, people being treated very poorly in these installations.
Well, you know, that's exactly right. And what I have found, sadly, as I've gone around and talked to people, is that, you know, there's not much sympathy for a contract chicken grower. There's not much understanding of rural people who have been squeezed for decades, can't make a living, are on the brink of bankruptcy often. The USDA will often underwrite one of these loans. And then if the contract grower has a problem with the way they're being treated, they don't get another flock because the contracts are flock to flock. And so they keep these people basically as serfs. And the Obama administration did promise to do something about this situation, and they basically chickened out.
Oh, no pun intended. One of the things that you write about in the book is that there has been a bit of a disconnect between the environmental movement and these folks working in rural America. I mean, the environmental movement tends to focus on conservation land and energy policy and water quality and things like that, and your group, Food and Water Watch, and so on. Let's talk for a moment about how all these changes that you've been talking about in farm policy have affected the environment.
Well, they have certainly affected the environment in every way, from the pesticides and the chemicals that are being used in producing these crops to the genetically engineered crops that end up having co-branded chemicals, herbicides that are becoming, the weeds are becoming resistant to the chemicals, and so twice as much of Roundup, for instance, one of the chemicals that is co-branded with Monsanto's seeds, is being dumped into waterways. And now the agribusiness is needing to come up with new chemicals that are even stronger. And so we're going to see atrazine and 2,4-D, which is one of the components of Agent Orange, used in growing these crops. And it's also depleted the soil. It's meant that we don't really have a system where food is produced in a way that the soil is nourished and the farm family is nourished and the consumer then gets a high-quality product. All of that profit and benefits from the environmental degradation gets kind of sucked up the supply chain.
And it's a really, I mean, it's not something that can go on forever.
That's
this
right.
is something that has a breaking point, and we're not at that breaking point yet, which is why it's important to do something about it, although it's certainly very hard to do things before crises happen, as we know with climate change.
Well, and, you know, the irony is that a lot of fossil fuel is used in this style of agriculture, and we need to change the way that we're doing things before we really begin experiencing the dramatic changes. And we know we're already beginning to experience climate changes in terms of rainfall, extreme weather events, and things are only going to get worse. And this is one of the causes of using too many fossil fuels. So we really need to grab a hold of our food system and do something so we can continue to feed people.
As you have written in this book, a system in which our own farmers themselves aren't nourished and all of that, it's not just in the United States. I mean, tell us what happens to third world countries when, as part of their economic development plan, they start exporting a whole lot of produce, for example.
Well, you know, I think what happened after NAFTA is one of the most dramatic examples. So U.S. farm policy is deregulated, and that means overproduction of corn, which is sent to Mexico. Also, the U.S., Mexico and Canada become parties to a trade agreement. As part of that trade agreement, Mexico changes its land ownership laws, and U.S. corporations begin moving in, and cheap corn is sold in Mexico. The peasant farmers are driven off their land to grow export crops, often fruits and vegetables. They end up in shanty towns on the edge of Mexico City and other urban areas, unable to make a living. Those crops are exported to the United States with more pesticides than are often applied here, and often food safety issues because of the conditions in the fields there. Meanwhile, the poor campesinas, the former peasant farmers, are driven over the border as they're looking for jobs. And we They're
here,
and you know,
and get a hostel.
Gotta have a hostel welcome, and the whole thing is so completely ironic. And really, the view of these multinational food companies and large grocers is that they want to export the kind of processed food that we eat here to have new markets. And they want new places to sell their seeds. And so we have a lot of nonsense about how we need to feed the world and our technologies need to feed the world, when actually our policies are preventing people from being properly nourished. And we have about 2 billion farmers who have been doing a pretty good job of feeding their communities. And we're actually supporting policies that are making it more difficult for them to feed their communities, and are actually doing things that are going to drive food production into this processed food arena where people are getting fat and sick like Americans.
Exactly. I was reading somewhere the other day about how Andean people can't buy quinoa anymore because it's being exported to us types who are
Eating it here.
Buying it at Whole Foods and things like that.
Right, exactly. There's so many unintended consequences.
Now, let's talk for a moment about junk food. Of course, junk food is one of the most profitable foods to make. It's a lot less profitable to grow celery and radishes and apples and things that are good for you, and more profitable to make food that actually is terrible for you.
Well, the food processing companies make the money from using cheap ingredients, fat, sugar, and salt. And they have figured out how to basically addict people through their collaboration with food scientists. These foods make people reach a bliss point, or it affects their brains, so they actually continually crave foods that are really bad for them. And then there's all of the advertising. The average child sees just under 5,000 junk food ads a year, and these processing companies start the advertising very young. They found that children have brand allegiance beginning at around 2.
Good heavens.
And that children are very large factors in what kind of food the family purchases. You'll notice where food items are placed. The foods that are the best for you are, if you're talking about a cereal that isn't heavily sweetened, it's up in the far corner shelf, while all the junk food cereals with all of the sugar and coloring and all of those things is down at the child's eye level.
And the children are saying, mommy, mommy,
mommy, mommy, mommy, mommy, buy this for me. And that's part of our problem. When you look at the amount of processed food that Americans buy, well, about 90% of the food budget goes to processed food, and 70% of that food is food that's really not good for you.
We're talking to Winona Howder, author of the book Foodopoly, The Battle Over the Future of Food and Farming in America. We were talking a moment ago about junk food, and there is a kind of, I don't know if it's like the food industry equivalent of greenwashing, but they are trying to sell some quote-unquote healthier products.
Well, they are, but when you look at their healthier products, it's usually something that maybe has reduced sugar, still has a lot of sugar. Or my favorite is when they say gluten-free, and it's something like a cracker that never had any gluten in it to begin with.
Yeah, or a bag of sugar or cough syrup or something.
And in fact, they're trying to move to this kind of labeling, facts up front it's called, that they would be able to use a so-called label to actually market their product. So, you know, they could say ice cream oh, look how many grams of calcium, and say that this is a good way to get your calcium requirement. So, you know, very deceptive, because it wouldn't talk about the problems with high-calorie ice cream.
And meanwhile, these are the same people who are trying to get other kinds of labeling off your food. For example, you're not allowed to say that a food is hormone-free.
Right, exactly. These large processing companies, and we have basically 20 large processing companies that own most of the brands in the grocery store, and they don't want a label. And they
except when it's in their favor.
Right, when it's in their favor. They don't want a truthful label.
So meanwhile, we've got 20 companies producing the majority of the food in our grocery stores, and simultaneously, we've got a kind of farm-to-table organic movement all over the country. How are these two things coexisting?
Well, I think the first thing we have to understand is that the processed food industry has figured out that they can make money on organics. And they don't view organics like you and I do as a source of better health, a way to be more environmentally sustainable. They don't view it this way at all. They view it as a niche market item that they can charge more for, and they actually want a weaker standard and have lobbied to have a weaker organic standard, things like allowing synthetics into organics. And so
synthetic?
Well, different synthetic chemicals that are used in the processing of, for instance, soy, something like hexane. And they have successfully done this, and it's all about making it cheaper to produce an organic product. Also, you know, I think it goes against the spirit of organics when you have these very, very large consolidated operations producing organic food, and they also are producing foods that really aren't necessarily good for you. So to me, an organic Oreo, which there are organic Oreos, really doesn't deserve an organic label, because this is not a real food. And
well, there's also, I mean, it's not in the organic standard because it can't be, but this, as you say, the spirit of the organic food idea is smaller farmers like the farm that you live on to this day, who know their animals, take good care of them, know their community, know their customers, selling food that they have handled to other people.
Right, and I think this is one of the things that people don't realize, and this is not just in organic food, this is in conventional food. The demand for volume and the desire to squeeze every bit of profit out of it has led the organics industry to consolidate all the way to the farm, just as it has led conventional food to become consolidated and to have much bigger enterprises. And this is true even for produce. We certainly see it in conventional produce. And we see it in organic produce, where we have a few big players that end up producing most of the organic produce in places like the Central Valley of California, or purchasing it overseas where they can procure it at an even cheaper price. So we're seeing more and more organic food coming from places like China. In fact, there's a good chance when you go and buy something like your Cascadian frozen corn or edamame that it was actually processed in China.
Very interesting. And so when it's organic, it may actually be healthier in the sense that it is not laden with pesticides and it's not genetically modified and so on, but the carbon footprint could be very high.
Yes, and you know, I'm very skeptical of producing large amounts of organic food in places like China. And I mean this as someone, I've traveled a couple of times to food safety meetings in China, and it became very clear to me that the Chinese are not in charge of their own regulatory system. It's such a large country. And I'm pretty cynical about the certifications that are going on. You know, we don't know how well the certifications programs work here in the U.S.
Well, according to your book, they're not very good.
Yeah, and it depends on who's doing them. Unfortunately, certifiers sometimes have a financial interest in working with a particular company, and it does not do them much good to be very strict. And so I just see this being magnified to a much larger problem in a place like China, or for that matter, Mexico or Latin America.
So we have a situation, and we haven't even talked about Monsanto and genetically modified foods and things like that. Let's talk for a moment about genetically modified foods. There are some people, and I've seen environmentalists. I saw Stuart Brand, who started the Whole Earth Catalog and is still considered a great environmentalist, standing in front of a room with hundreds of people saying that genetically modified food is going to save the world.
Well, you know, I'm not sure where he got his position from, but when you look at the details, it actually would probably do the opposite, because this is all about the profitability of seeds and about companies like Monsanto controlling seeds. For thousands of years, farmers have saved seeds. They've developed versions of plants that over time that grow well in their soil and their climate, and these are traditional foods. And what the food industry really wants to do, including Monsanto, is to find new markets for their products, to move in our grains and the ingredients for junk foods, to process them in these countries, and we're seeing that more and more so with companies like PepsiCo, for instance, which is the largest food processor in the United States. They're processing much more of their products in countries where they want to sell it and where it's cheaper. And so this isn't really about feeding people. If we wanted to feed people, we would make seeds available, maybe seeds that had been that these farmers were already interested in using. We would help them with equipment. A lot of peasant farmers only have one shovel. I mean, there are a lot of things that we could help with infrastructure. But what we're doing is pushing these people into the dollar economy so that they can buy products and basically be destitute. You know, you're talking about people who would make $1 or $2 a day. It's a really a draconian plot, in my view.
We're talking to Winona Howder. Now, let's talk for a moment, because it's possible to read your book and become kind of depressed about the situation, and with good reason, but it's also true that the environmental and safe food movements have actually had some real effect already and are working very hard. What positive impact has the environmental and the safe food movement had?
Well, you know, I think that without the movement that we've seen, we would be eating many, many more genetically engineered products. We really have been in a battle over our food system, and I think what we've seen most recently that's given me a lot of hope is when the labeling initiative in California failed by just fewer than 3 points, there was a lot of anger around the country, and it has spurred a huge grassroots movement in more than 30 states where legislation to label GE foods has been introduced, where people are meeting regularly, where people are doing planning initiatives. There's a initiative that will be voted on in Washington State this fall that looks, it looks very well organized. They're raising a lot of money. It's a much smaller state to try to run ads in and so forth. And I think that people are furious that the FDA is on the brink of legalizing genetically engineered salmon, that they legalized sweet corn, genetically engineered sweet corn last year, that right now in the Federal Register yesterday there was a notice that there are 7 new genetically engineered corn and soy products that are going through the approval process. And this is just spurring a huge grassroots movement. And really, that's what we need.
What do we know about the health effects of genetically modified foods or genetically engineered foods?
Well, we do know that there have been animal feeding studies and that there are documented cases of liver and kidney malfunctions, problems with metabolizing genetically engineered food, rat mothers that were fed genetically engineered feed, that their pups did not develop properly. Now, the problem is that because companies like Monsanto own the patents and don't give the patents to scientists, it's been very difficult to have the body of research that we should have about the long-term consequences and health problems related to genetically engineered food. And so the industry loves to say, well, people have been eating this stuff and nothing's happening. Well, we don't really know if a lot of the health problems that people have, we don't really know the long-term consequences. And we do know a lot of the environmental problems, the super weeds, the overuse of pesticides and herbicides. So, and we do know the control that a couple of seed companies have over the seed market, which there could be no health effects, and that would be a very dangerous thing. So I think we have plenty of information, and I'm hoping to see some money freed up and some more research in the future, because, you know, people are right now having a lot of genetically engineered food. I mean, think about things like Similac that infants are being fed.
What is that? What's in
Similac
it?
Is, well, it has a lot of soy, and almost most soy and corn are genetically engineered today. And so that means that these infants are being fed genetically engineered product. Nobody really knows what the long-term health effects. I mean, a lot of people have a lot of allegations around allergies and autism and those types of problems. But, you know, the research hasn't really been done. But think about how irresponsible that is.
Well, basically, we're being used as
lab rats and guinea pigs. That's exactly right.
Now, what kind of a political movement do we need? Because as you, I think, rightly said in your book, we can't just shop our way out of this problem. First of all, why can't we?
Well, we can't shop our way out of it because most of us cannot grow every type of food that we eat. And I think most of us would like to see a food system that is adequate for everyone, that furnishes safe and affordable food. And I think the problems with our food system magnify the problems with our democracy and the fact that policies are for sale. And I think we want to pass on a good food system. I think we want to pass on a more vibrant democracy. And my fantasy is that all of the people who are energized and interested in local and healthy food could become politicized and more involved in civic affairs, and that would be a good thing for the food system and for our democratic form of government.
If we all just shopped only at farmers markets, would that solve the problem?
Well, first of all, that's not feasible in a post-industrial society with very large population centers. I mean, I think about New York City, where there are a lot of farmers in the Hudson Valley that have no market because there's a very long list to get in the very popular farmers markets. And, you know, we have grocery stores because a complex society needs a distribution system. Now, the problem is that the grocery industry has become too consolidated with four grocery chains basically controlling a lot of the food supply and demanding high volume. So we need to take back some of these businesses. We need to look at what's happened to our antitrust laws over the last three and a half decades. And that's really why I wrote Foodopoly. I wanted us to have a more sophisticated analysis of what needs to change to fix our food system.
And also more health and safety regulation.
Right.
I mean, this stuff is being eroded because of the revolving door between industry and Washington, D.C., as has been talked about ad infinitum on programs like this and Democracy Now. But right. It's true. And, I mean, you have described in your book a system where instead of having meat inspectors inside of the meat packing plants, they are outside doing paperwork, and when bloody, pus-oozing, half-dead animals go to slaughter covered with their own feces, the way they handle it is at the end they wash them off with ammonia.
Right, and you know, the Obama administration just privatized one of the last steps in the poultry industry so that now these slaughter lines can move quickly. So I think it's getting people involved in these nuts and bolts issues. You know, it's we have a food farm bill. We call it the farm bill, but really we should call it the food bill because we have this system that has to feed more than 300 million people today. We need to, as these pieces of legislation move through Congress, be able to have people up on the kind of the details. And I think that that's...
Which isn't so easy all the time.
That's not so easy. People are busy. It's, you know, one of my concerns about just focusing on subsidies, which is, you know, that's just a small part of the dysfunction. We could get rid of subsidies tomorrow and we'll still have the same dysfunctional food system. We'll have a lot fewer farmers, but we will still have the same food system. We need people to become engaged. And that's why I'm excited about these state-based campaigns, like the ones on GE labeling, and getting people kind of involved in these issues in their own state. And people get involved in politics usually because of issues. And I think one of the reasons that Congress is in such deplorable shape is that in a lot of places in this country, people have not been engaged much in state politics, and we have had a lot of very radical fringe-type legislators elected, and they, every 10 years, are responsible for the redistricting that happens and how the House of Representatives is apportioned. And that has meant that these very radical right-wing legislators have gerrymandered the districts in their state to get the kind of people elected that they want, and they're not representative of the American people. So this is one of the reasons that I think the food issues can serve as a way to get people more engaged in their community, because if we're going to, for instance, pass laws on genetic engineering, you know, it's a very good thing to pass a local city council resolution that educates people to do that in a lot of places, and then you're ready to pass state legislation over maybe 2 or 3 years, and that's the kind of organizing it's going to take to really get the kind of engagement we need so that we can take back our food system.
Winona Howder is executive director of Food and Water Watch, and she's the author of the new book, Foodopoly, The Battle Over the Future of Food and Farming in America. She will be speaking tonight here in Santa Fe at Collected Works Bookstore on Galisteo Street. That's at 6 o'clock. And she will be tomorrow, Wednesday, at Moby Dickens in Taos at 2 in the afternoon. And then on Thursday, she will be in Albuquerque at Bookworks at 7 in the evening. And for more information on all of those events and much, much more, you can go to foodopoly.org. And if you get the book, you can also look at Foodopoly for big pictures of all the graphs and much more kind of graphic sense of what you're talking about in this book. It's a great website. Winona Howder, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much for having me.